Good morning. Well, it's the Easter bank holiday weekend. Are you being a cool cat or maybe a bit of a crybaby?
I've always lived by this golden rule. Whatever happens, don't blow your cool. You gotta have nerves of steel and never show folks how you honestly feel. I've lived my whole life this way. For example, take yesterday. I breezed home happy, bringing her my pay. Her note read, so long, sappy, I have run away. I threw myself down across our empty bed, and this is what I said. But I was cool. So I won for the road.
Ooh, and I tip my hat to John Kelly for that one. And on lyric, as you might expect, standards are being upheld.
Broadcasting from the attic. That's all we do here. We just play tunes. Now, I don't want you to think they're just fired on at random. There's a rehearsals, just like the old days. Rehearsals begin at 6 o'clock in the morning, and there's a full dress rehearsal in the afternoon, and then we do it for real now. It's so exciting.
Smoking jackets, dry martinis, and an ironically raised eyebrow. Lyric, a station that keeps its cool. And if you're looking out your window this fine Saturday morning, I do hope it isn't from your holiday home, because highborn city folk getting out of Dodge to rural beauty spots was something that occupied a lot of airtime this week. Christy Moore was Ryan Tuberty's guest yesterday. Yes, the Tubbs is back, more and on. But Christy had this to say on the whole affair.
It makes me feel so proud the way we have responded to this terrible crisis. And I suppose sad to hear about the miscreants who behave so badly. You know, I had a thought this morning hearing about the people who are flocking to the holiday places. I had this thought that, you know, those videos of people spitting at shop assistants and spitting at guards. And it's like as if those people are spitting at the nation. In a way, you know, they're saying, we don't mind, we're above all this. We're going to go away for the weekend. We're going to go out and we're going to keep our jollies going.
Yeah.
That makes me feel sad and frustrated, even a little bit angry sometimes.
Christy Moore, not a man to make angry, or he might sing a song about you, and it's not going to be the voyage. But make no mistake, holiday homeowners were not being welcomed by local people. Here's the view from Lahinch, courtesy of John Cook, on Drive Time.
There definitely is a lot of holidaymakers. We're very local people and we use this to exercise on a daily basis. So we don't want the backwasher, the people coming on their day trips, or even into the holiday homes that are occupied at the moment. And
you say a lot of holiday homes are already occupied for Easter?
Absolutely, they have been for the last 2 weeks. You know, I hate to say you're not welcome, but you're not welcome. Stay in your own registered address, please, and don't come here. You're really not welcome, not at this time.
Kate, you like walking the prom, tell me why.
Yeah, it's good for my mental health. I find it very therapeutic.
You're here most days doing this, so you're going through a particularly bad time at present.
Well, I have stage 4 ovarian cancer. I find the beach and outdoors is my therapy.
Do you feel more at risk and vulnerable now to coronavirus?
Well, to be honest, yes. I'd be a fool not to say I wasn't. However, it's up to everybody, every individual, to do what they can to put a stop to this. And I think, you know, selfish humans, like, there's 1% of humans, no matter what you do, there'll be assholes. That's just my stuff.
Is that how you would regard people who might come to the beach and come to the sea for the Easter weekend?
I do, yes. Yeah, I really do, because you're not just putting yourself at risk, you're also putting society in a hole.
So, 1%. Well, on Wednesday, Minister for Health Simon Harris announced stricter measures to prevent the city exodus. Here he is on Morning Ireland.
I know that this weekend is a very important weekend. It's often a weekend that's very important both in terms of people's faith and families. And yet we're going to need people this weekend to have a very different Easter to what they normally have. We saw 36 of our citizens die yesterday of COVID-19. We are making progress in this country, and there's no doubt about that across a number of metrics. But now is not the time for any complacency whatsoever. And as difficult and challenging, and I really know it is challenging for people to have to stay at home, people with kids, I'm conscious of parents of children with autism and the likes. These are big challenges for people. But they're not as challenging and significant as the other problems that could arise if we don't stay the course. And we're seeing what's happening in other countries in terms of the death toll, and we simply cannot allow that happen here.
So no room for complacency. And Minister Harris went on to say, in a roundabout fashion, and to borrow a rival's phrase, a lot done, more to do.
But as Dr. Tony Houlihan, the Chief Medical Officer, has very clearly said, despite the fact that we are making progress as a country, this virus is not where we need it to be. I mean, we shouldn't fool ourselves as people in any way if we think that this virus is in a sustainable position. It is not. We need to continue to drive down the rate of infection in our country. And it is back to the key message from the start that our doctors keep on saying. They can save hundreds of lives during this pandemic. We, the Irish people, can save thousands. And now is the time, difficult and challenging as it is, for all of us to really double down in terms of our own personal efforts at home, staying at home, and making those difficult sacrifices in the interest of keeping us all safe.
Minister Simon Harris on Wednesday's Morning Ireland. And yesterday at a 4 o'clock press conference, we got the answer to the question that was being asked by almost everyone. Are we nearly there yet? And the answer, not quite.
So today's message is that we cannot be complacent and we cannot lose focus. What we're doing is difficult, but it is making a difference, and we have to keep going. We need to persevere, and we need to maintain our discipline and resolve. The restrictions we introduced 2 weeks ago were set to expire on Sunday. Today, the expert recommendation is to extend them for a further 3 weeks until Tuesday, May 5th. The government has accepted this recommendation. I know many of us would like to know when things will go back to normal and life will be as it was. We are working towards that time, and we're planning carefully so that we get there safely. The truth is, nobody knows for certain when that will be or how our lives will be different when it comes. All we can do for now is to take one day at a time, to think of others, and to choose hope and solidarity over self-interest and fear. Your decisions will save lives. What may be an inconvenience for some will be life-saving for others. So I'm calling on everyone to do what is asked of them, to be tolerant and compassionate, to think about each other before we think about ourselves. Nothing greater will be asked of any of us.
So May 5th it is then, and restrictions extended as everyone had anticipated. Hard to argue with. And also, of course, the Leaving Cert has been postponed and the Junior Cert effectively cancelled or replaced by classroom tests. But earlier on Morning Ireland, Gavin Jennings had spoken to Killian de Gascoigne, chair of the Coronavirus Expert Advisory Group and laboratory director at the National Virus Reference Laboratory, who explained the numbers and the need for restrictions.
The percentage of new cases day on day has fallen from over 30% at the start of the epidemic to less than 10%. So that's a really positive step, but the problem is it still needs to be zero. The number of infections that are resulting from an infection, the reproductive number, the R0, has fallen from an average of between 4 and 5 to between 2 and 3. That's very positive, but that needs to be less than 1. So they're the type of, I suppose, who we've made a lot of progress, but we need to do better before I think we can realistically lift those restrictions. However, we are conscious of the fact that the restrictions are very difficult for people and they are not sustainable in the long term. So what we would hope to do is be able to lift those within the next perhaps couple of weeks and then monitor the situation from a virus perspective and then perhaps increase the restrictions again if needs be, depending on the number of cases, depending on the number of people going into hospital, the number of people going into intensive care. Ultimately, what we have to try and do is control the impact on our health service. And if we get to a situation where, for example, we have a 1,000 new cases per day, then that will overwhelm our intensive care system in a very short period of time. And I think while people will be finding the restrictions difficult, I think we just need to look at other countries like Italy, like the United States, like Spain. This virus, if given an opportunity, can run rampant, and it's really important that people, that we can't become complacent, even though we have had a very successful implementation of measures thus far. There's still a long way to go, unfortunately.
And key to much of our handling of this crisis is linked to contact tracing and testing. Back to Gavin.
How long is it taking to get a test result now?
So there are two separate groups based on the restrictions we have in supplies. So we're prioritising samples from hospitalised patients and for healthcare workers, and where those are readily identifiable, they are getting results within 24, 48 hours. And then I suppose there's the community side of things, where these are people who have been deemed not to require hospitalisation and can stay at home and can self-isolate and manage themselves. Those individuals, some of them I know will be waiting 7, 10, 14 days for results, and I know that's not good enough. But as I said, significant measures have been introduced over the last week, and this week in particular, in the context of increasing lab capacity and bringing new platforms. People know that we've been talking about global shortages of lysis buffer and extraction reagents over recent weeks. So what we've done is moved to different platforms with different supply chains, so that ourselves and the NVRL and the hospitals around the country aren't all pulling from the same supply chain, if you like. So we're hopeful that that will give us more resilience in the coming weeks and months, but also allow us to scale up our capacity significantly.
Chair of the Coronavirus Expert Advisory Group, Killian de Gascoigne, on yesterday's Morning Ireland. And if we were in any doubt as to the toll this is taking on families and the health system, John called into Liveline. His wife is a healthcare assistant in a Dublin hospital who is by the bedside at the end of people's lives.
She would normally, natural instinct would come to any healthcare worker out there, is to hold the person's hand when they're dying. But she felt that it was an unnatural feeling for her because she was covered in head to toe in PPE. She had double layer of gloves on, and all you could see was her eyes. And as this person passed, she just felt it was a natural thing for her to do, to hold that person's hand. But the doctor tapped her on the shoulder and said, "Don't do that," even though she had double gloves on. Unfortunately, the person passed away, and the protocols in hospital for any death is to try and get the family involved. And my wife's job would be part of our job, and every healthcare assistant out there would understand this, would be to prepare the person so that their family could see them. So they would remove any medical equipment that might have been used, intubations, IV lines, whatever, and they would clean the body, present it, and depending on the religion of the person, they would maybe place, if they were a Catholic, they would place rosary beads around their hands, put them into a fresh bed, and if possible, if it's possible in the hospital, to bring the person into a room on their own, have a candle and a crucifix. And the family can come in and then spend time with their loved one. But in this particular incident, and unfortunately since then, she's dealt with one or two more. The best way to describe it is it's something out of a movie where they have to wrap the body up, remove all the medical equipment as normal, clean the body, and then wrap it in whatever they're lying in. Sheets that they're lying in is all wrapped. Okay. A face mask is placed over the nose and mouth. And then the body is placed inside a body bag. They take the body away as soon as they possibly can, down to the mortuary. Now, my wife had a 13-hour shift last week when this happened. And herself and a colleague, they said their prayers over this person, just very quietly. And then they took the body out, took all the equipment out, the bed out for deep cleaning. And then they went and had a break. And normally, you know, staff would relate to this. They would normally have a conversation about what they've just experienced so that they can bounce off one another. But she said that there was no conversation between her and her colleague. They just had a quick cup of tea, 20-minute break, as they normally take, and then they were gowned back up again and straight back into the front line.
And this is how John ended his call.
There was one very vivid thing that she said, which is all of her and all of our colleagues, they step into the front line every day. They're coming under enemy fire, and they're doing their best. They're putting up the best fight that they can. But she said, if people only realised that when we're fighting, we're actually fighting in a minefield. Mm. And none of us know which one of our colleagues is going to step on a mine and be taken out of the fight. So I would say to people who are determined to go to their holiday homes, wherever it is, and go walking on the beach, please think of that image.
Yeah.
That if you're walking on the beach and there's people in front of you stepping on mines, would you carry on walking on that beach?
John on Tuesday's Liveline. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now, if you're from Wexford, and I do mean a native of Wexford, not just sitting in your holiday home at Curraghlow Beach, you might know what this means.
If you don't go on slurry, you'll get caught in the down gurry.
That is a dialect called Forth and Bargy, which is spoken in the southeast of Ireland, Wexford in particular, in ye olden times. And on Monday, Oliver Callan spoke to Sasha Sanchi Cooney, a linguistic student in UCD, who's just published a book about this dialect, something he started researching when he was in transition year.
Transition year is like lockdown for an entire year anyway, isn't it?
Well, I didn't do much dossing.
Okay, no, it doesn't sound like it.
Not at all, in fact, and Oliver asked Sasha for some examples and translations.
A slurry is mist, and a downgurry is a heavy downpour. I mean, you could interpret it metaphorically. Yeah. If you don't know it now, you might not get the opportunity later.
Okay. Give us a bit more.
The wind will cut the burr off you.
Okay, right. What's that?
The wind will cut the cheek off you.
Wow, the burr.
The burr, your so burr. And that comes from Irish.
I was wondering.
A lot of words came from Irish.
I was wondering if some of it comes from. It's kind of a half Middle English. And my arm was vanged.
Vanged, yes, sprained. My arm was vanged from weeding or working.
The horse was. How do you pronounce that? Hacking, is it?
Hatching.
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 Oh, you have to elongate it. Hatching.
Oh yeah, you have to draw them out. You have to draw the vowels out.
Hatching. That was Sasha Sanchi Cooney with a bit of Forth and Bargy with Oliver Callan on Monday. A good old-fashioned scrap broke out, quite unexpectedly, on Wednesday's drive time. So lace up your footwear of choice, because it's walkers versus joggers. First up, Amanda Brunker, columnist, dog owner and walker.
Unfortunately, the joggers have become an absolute, nearly a virus in themselves going around. New joggers especially, who are not used to doing this sort of activity, and all of a sudden they're going up the road, they're not giving people a wide distance, and they're coughing, they're wheezing, and of course, most disgusting of all, they're spitting a lot, and it's just not on.
They're spitting?
Yes. Well, if you're not used to moving, and all of a sudden you're moving quite a lot, unfortunately, it does tend to bring up phlegm, and a lot of joggers come out of nowhere, you don't know where they're coming from, and then next minute they're looking at you like you're actually taking over their pavement. And it's almost like, how dare you be on my pavement with your dogs?
Step up Connor Pope, consumer journalist and self-described sometime runner.
I run, I walk, I have a dog, I cycle and I drive. So if I was to have a foot in all camps,
you're ticking all the boxes.
Feet.
Yeah.
So I just don't think it's helpful to be pitting one section of our community against another section of our community at this time. I have sympathy for what Amanda's saying, and I have had experiences where runners have come too close to me. But in my experience, I have been going to huge lengths to distance myself from other people when I'm out for a run. I was out for a run this morning. wasn't a very fast run, but I went out and I was, as I said, I was going to enormous lengths to ensure that I didn't run past anybody else. Not just for them, but for myself. Mm. Because I think one of the points that Amanda is missing here is the reason why somebody who's running would want to go past Amanda at a safe distance is because they don't know if Amanda has the virus or not. So it's not about me giving her the virus. It could be about her giving me the virus.
Oh, it's on now.
Amanda, when the joggers come by you, is it the jogger as much as, I suppose, people running, and you say a lot of new people out jogging who might normally have been in the gym, are they coming panting by you?
Very much so. And while I'm not going to call Connor a liar in any respect, I'm sure he is a very kind of good citizen and is giving everybody their space.
Yeah, because there are lots, Amanda. We better say there are lots of very respectful runners and respectful joggers out there.
There's not enough, unfortunately, though.
Oh.
And even, I'm not alone. Paris is after banning jogging. because it's just too much of a risk for people. Mm. And like, all I would suggest is people maybe do the couch, instead of couch to 5K, maybe couch around the back garden, couch up and down the stairs. You know, find another way for exercise.
Amanda, that somebody, that's assuming that somebody has a back garden. And an awful lot of people, the only form of exercise they can get is to leave their homes, go for a run while respecting social distances.
Well, distancing. How about this,
and I
Connor?
Don't think that's something that you should Connor. Be criticising. Because I think what we should be targeting here, we should all be working together to ensure that everybody, runners, walkers, cyclists and motorists, all have respect for other people. Now,
okay,
let me just
well,
give you an example. I was walking down my road a couple of days ago and I experienced what I can only describe as a drive-by spitting. Some motorist pulled down their window and gobbed into the road right beside me. So, you know, I could then write a column saying, all motorists are terrible because somebody spat at my feet. It's a disgusting thing. Joggers, runners, spitting or wheezing or panting in our space is revolting. It shouldn't be done. But the message that we should be getting out there is everybody, be they walking, cycling, running or driving, needs to respect other people and needs to maintain the appropriate
okay.
distance.
Amanda.
It's not good to target people.
Connor, Amanda?
I've forgotten my point, to be honest. It was so long ago I wanted to make it.
Sweaty pants all over the shop, but a curiously enjoyable listen. That was Wednesday's Drive Time. And there were other unexpected moments of the tetchy and the slightly strange on the radio. On the Seán O'Rourke Show, former Conservative politician Edwina Curry came on the line to give an update on the health of Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
And I think everybody is rooting for him. You know, there was a moment yesterday when the person who's standing in for him, the First Minister Dominic Raab, when he said, look, he's not only the Prime Minister, but he's our boss and he's also our friend. And you realise that actually this is a remarkable man and we're all rooting for him. I mean, trust him to go and want to share the experience of the British people by catching the damn thing.
And while we all wish Boris Johnson well and a very quick recovery, I'm not exactly sure that's how a virus works, but we'll park the science there. But it was when Seán asked this question that the facts became, well, a little bit loose.
Speaking of data, statistics and analysis, Edwina, there's one piece of analysis out from a group called the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation in Seattle in the United States. And they have some very, very scary statistics and projections. They say that Britain will become the country worst hit by the coronavirus pandemic in Europe, accounting ultimately for more than 40% of the total deaths in the continent. They're predicting 66,000 UK deaths by August from COVID-19, with a peak of nearly 3,000 a day.
That seems to be an outlying prediction, I must say. I mean, at the moment, if you look at the figures, you'll find that Ireland has a higher proportion of cases for its population than we have.
Really? Is that the case? Well, texters into the Seán O'Rourke Show did not seem to think so.
Lots of texts, by the way, coming in, not surprisingly, about Edwina Curry. And taking issue, as I probably should have done myself when we were talking about the statistics for death from coronavirus across the water as compared to here. Latest figures says one listener per million in the UK, 91, Ireland, 43. They're not equal. Facts are very important during this pandemic. Credit is where it's due. Well done, Ireland. Another one. Why is RTE interviewing Edwina Curry? They refuse to listen to the WHO. They refuse to listen to the EU. And the outcome is thousands and thousands of elderly British people are dying unnecessarily in dreadful circumstances, and all they can do is massage the figures of fatalities. Compare and contrast with the wonderful humane approach of the EU's most dynamic country, Germany. That's from John in Clontarf. Another one, signing off as hubris. Hi, Edwina Curry referenced the UK's effectiveness in dealing with COVID-19 compared to Ireland. According to the Johns Hopkins tracker, the UK mortality rate is running at 9.28 per 100,000 people. The Irish rate is 4.33. But I suppose a lot of this will depend on the kind of testing and the rate at which results come through. But when it comes to death statistics, they're perhaps a bit more definitive. And the last one, Edwina Curry says Ireland has more COVID cases per head of population in comparison to the UK. Well, their recovery rate is three times worse than Ireland's. Lies, damn lies and statistics, says another caller now.
Ooh, the old enmity is never really far from the surface, is it? That was the Seán O'Rourke Show on Wednesday. In the Darcy household, things are progressing, but it's doubling and not floating. The sourdough, that is.
Don't do it. Don't start. Don't start. It's a weird world you'll get into. I'm on day nine of the sourdough starter saga. And it is doubling in size, but it's not floating. Now, that means absolutely nothing to most people. But it's supposed to double in size, your combination of flour and water. And then when it's ready to be used to make sourdough bread, it's supposed to float. And that's the test. It's not floating yet. And I'm losing the will to continue with it. But now I've invested 9 days. It's not 9 days. It takes 5 minutes every day to take it out, weigh it, add some more flour, some more water, wash the jar, put it back into the jar. And my advice to you is don't do it. But, you know, it could be something. It could be something.
It better be something. I'm kind of invested in it at this point. I've even given it a name. Maureen Jasog. So come on, the sourdough. Back in a bit. Welcome back.
Good morning, all. This is Ryan Tuberty with you. It is Tuesday, the 7th of April, 2020. Good to be back and good to have you with us this sunny Tuesday morning.
The Tuberty is back. And thankfully, as he explained, his experience with the virus was pretty okay.
I got the thing and I was very, very fortunate. Very, very fortunate. And I should fill you in on that good fortune just briefly. And it's not to gloat or anything like that. It wasn't a particularly lovely thing to experience. But I was very fortunate in the sense that I had this persistent cough. I got it checked out. The test came back positive. And that's all that happened. In my case, nothing else happened. I didn't have a fever. I didn't have the flu. I didn't take as much as a pill, paracetamol. It was that low level and almost negligible amount of the virus that. But yet I disappeared because I felt it was the right thing to do.
And Ryan used the time in self-isolation to take stock and perhaps recalibrate and, yes, appreciate all the good things in life.
When you're told that your test has come back positive, you'd think a lot about a lot of things, albeit briefly, but you do reflect. And it's not a particularly pleasant thing to have to think about, but you do. But fortunately, like I say, I was in a very fortunate position that I didn't have a serious dose of this thing. And therefore, I am back and happy to be here, very happy to be here, and very, very grateful to lots of different people for lots of different things. Because I thought about a lot of things and talking about life, reflect, you have time and you think about people who you love and loved and you think about how grateful you are for the great things that happen in life. And that could be watching birds on a feeder. It could be watching a movie with your kids. And you think about what you miss. And when you're stuck in a house, and I think about all our friends listening this morning who are cocooning, keep thinking about people who are in their 70s. Because we've been talking about how long, for so long here, how 70 isn't old anymore. It used to be. It's just not. Even 80s doesn't feel that old. I know too many octogenarians who simply don't act, look, or feel, or seem old at all. And yet you have to cocoon and you're being brilliant. That's not plumos, it's just true. And oftentimes I would listen to the sounds on the street and I'd be envious hearing kids on their dad's shoulders or children in prams being pushed and that lovely sound of freedom and youth and hope and kindness and innocence. And I thought, God, a lot of people are missing that sort of thing. And maybe that's what gets you reflective. God, those sounds. I missed the sea. I missed walking, the freedom of it. And now I have it. I went walking this morning at 7 o'clock just to get that shot of sea breeze in my lungs, and man, it felt good.
Morning shots of sea breeze, Ryan on Tuesday. The man is back. Over on Culturefile on Lyric, curator and writer Ralph Rogoff spoke to Luke Clancy about an exhibition called Among the Trees.
This first area we're in is very much about trees and forests as these dense interconnecting structures and systems. And you know, in the background I think there's also this idea that scientists have been working on for the last three decades about what's called the wood wide web, how trees in a forest communicate with each other through an underground network of roots, fungi, and bacteria. and they can send chemical and electrical signals to each other. So trees under attack from a pest in one part of the forest can actually send out an alarm that other trees will receive in another part. You enter in the gallery and it's a slightly dark room. Individual pictures are spotlit, and there are a group of walls breaking up the space. Hopefully it feels a little bit like you've just left the city behind and entered a forest. Most of these works, which are photographs and drawings, focus on trees and forests as kind of branching, interconnecting structures. And artists, I think, are fascinated by this branching form of the tree. We're standing in front of an image of a jungle in Japan by the German photographer Thomas Struth, and there's no real foreground or background in this picture. It's just this dense matrix of branches crisscrossing each other, stones, moss, the kind of thing most people wouldn't stop and think, oh, that's a good photograph. But I think what interested the artist was the idea that in a forest, there is no foreground or background in a way. This is why I think we get scared in forests, because we can get lost in them very easily. But he wanted to make a picture. He said what interested him was the structure of the forest is so intricate, so interconnected, so full of detail, that it asks you in a way to suspend your analytical way of thinking and just to look and be in the moment.
Culture File on Lyric FM. The difficulty of simply sitting still and breathing was the focus of the opening piece on Sudden Miscellany by Maurice Crowe.
The first time I witnessed mindfulness meditation was in a cowshed in West Clare. Outside the cowshed, I squelched and dripped, moving like a robot in restricting rain gear, trying to make myself useful, as humans sometimes need to do, even in the most ludicrous conditions. Inside the shed stood four donkeys, gazing softly, as mindfulness practice would suggest, out the door. Because they weren't looking at me, I joined them in the shed. My need not so much to be present as to be in their presence. The donkeys ignored my soaking wet intrusion, deep in the stillness of their meditation. I stood amongst them seeking attention. When none was offered, I lay an arm over the animal to either side of me. The rise and fall of their bodies was grace-filled, gentle. They looked out at the teeming rain as it cross-stitched into the estuary waters, a basket of great thread above, below and beyond. The rhythm of the rain on the corrugated roof was ornamented by the gush from the gullies and the eaves. If they saw what I saw, they didn't react, but seemed to accept each moment, each raindrop, without judgment, watching it dissolve as the coming moment replaced it.
And these Zen master donkeys had some pretty groovy names.
Priscilla, Star, Flip and Flop coursed the same route each day and night. They remain watchful for each movement and change, noticing, not judging, accepting, not reacting. They continue to teach if the lesson is sought, and continue doing with ease what can be so difficult to do. Breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out.
A piece by Maurice Crowe as heard on Sunday Miscellany. And staying in the moment, if we can, philosopher Alain de Botton was Ray Darcy's guest.
You quote Blaise Pascal, "The sole cause of man's unhappiness is that he cannot stay quietly in his room."
That's right. I mean,
Blaise Pascal, great Catholic thinker, French mathematician, theologian. You know, what he really meant was we need distraction because there are fundamental things in our lives, like the fact we're all going to die, like the fact that much of what we do has no meaning, etc., that is so frightening that we use the busyness of everyday life to distract us. And his view is, if you're able to spend time on your own and you're not freaked out by the prospect, that is a sign that you have come to a graceful accommodation with the big things of life. That the people who are fidgeting and running about are those who are in some ways unreconciled to the kind of facts of existence. And so it's a little gentle encouragement there to spend time with yourself.
And what about, I was saying this the other day, that we fill our lives with distractions to get from A to B, A being birth, B being death. And that's what modern life is. Shopping, work, sport, hobbies, all distractions.
Well, you know, I think one of the things we're realizing in this kind of interregnum is that there's a lot of pleasure to be found in so-called small things. You know, a lot of the time our ambitions are huge. They're about what's going to happen next year and, you know, this big purchase we're going to make, et cetera. A lot of that's come to an end. And so we're focused on very small things. You know, there's some sunshine coming in and it's lighting up some daffodils. Yes. Now, normally you'd think that's ridiculous. You know, don't stop me for something like this. Now all of us are reduced to some of the state of wonder and grace, if I can put it, of a very small child. You know how small children, you take them for a walk in the park, and in a way they're maddening but also amazing because everything is interesting. You know, the way that moss is growing on the side of a wall or cracks between paving stones, it's all gripping because they've never seen it before. And I think that when we're in confinement, we are being invited by the universe to focus back in on some of these things. It could be a piece of toast that you're having, or a very warm bath, or a conversation with a friend. You know, the world has stilled, and in that stillness, we're able to see certain things much better. And one of the things we notice is how grateful we can be for so many of the little things that we miss on the path to a glorious future. We don't know what our future is going to be like now. And so that invites us to look more closely at what we already have.
And Alain de Botton was quite robust in his rejection of any grander meaning or plan at play when it came to this virus.
And what do you think about the future? Will mankind be better for this?
Look, I resist sort of quasi-religious interpretations of natural disasters. This is a natural disaster. It's not meaningful. It wasn't there to punish the wicked.
No, I don't think it is.
I'm not saying you're saying this, but, you know, some people have this view that kind of it's come to cleanse us for our sins.
Yes.
You know, no, it hasn't. It's just a virus. You know, it's not, you can layer on everything you want, but basically, you know, look, I think like anything, we can place a meaning on it. We can, each of us, you know, it's a reminder of death and finitude. And each of us can use the thought of death to nudge us towards the way of life that we would optimally lead. So it's like a giant memento mori. It's like a skull on your desk. It's saying you're going to end up dead. How do you want to spend the remaining days and years?
Yeah.
And I think all of us can do with maybe sharpening up our sense of how we really should be living.
Alain de Botton with Ray Darcy. Being in the moment, just breathing, and all of this talk about smelling the flowers and finding a higher purpose can create its own pressure. Because what if you've looked deep into the abyss and decided what really made you happy was some potato waffles? And instead of experiencing Walden Pond moments of clarity, you're seething inside about the state of the bins, sitting round in your PJs eating pasta from the pot, scratching a few spots, and binge-watching, well, really any old crap on a flickering screen. Namaste, not so much. If so, rest easy. Here's Marion Keyes, who spoke to Miriam O'Callaghan on Sunday.
How are you spending your time?
I mean, I'm feck acting around on social media, to be honest. I am achieving nothing, absolutely nothing. I'm not writing anything because I can't concentrate. And, you know, I think there's this expectation, if people are at home on their own, that they're going to be incredibly creative, or they're going to learn to play the clarinet or you know, conversational Mandarin. And I think that's awful pressure that people are putting on themselves. Like, these are not normal circumstances, and this isn't a holiday. And I think people feel very, very guilty for not doing these, you know, for not fulfilling the dream that they always thought they would have if they had enough time. So I'm achieving nothing except being on Twitter 28 hours a day and the rest of the time being on Instagram, mostly messing around with foundations and skincare. And, oh yeah, and dyeing my hair.
Oh, award-winning authors sitting around. Well, that's a relief. And Miriam, sharp as a tack, has the follow-up question about the hair.
How did that turn out, actually?
It turned out beautifully, Miriam. It is so funny. Like, you know, this obviously will change us as a society in you know, various ways.
Yeah.
And one of the ways is that I'm now swaggering around thinking that I need never go to the hairdresser again, which is absolute codswallop. But, no, the home dye job turned out grand, actually. Yeah. And, you know, the bathroom is still, it doesn't look like an abattoir at the moment.
And do you think it will change us, what we're going through at the moment? Or will we just all go right back to the way we were?
I hope not. I mean, I hope that we really value the so-called unskilled workers, like the people who are in the supermarkets right now, you know, restocking our shelves, you know, manning the cash points, the tills, and that we will pay our nurses properly. I mean, they are literally putting their lives on the line for us right now, and they are being paid, you know, a ridiculously small amount of money for it. I would really like that we would reconfigure our priorities.
And she had this advice to offer as to how to stay sane.
Do the kind of the basics in taking care of yourself, and to kind of accept that kind of fundamentally we're all powerless, and all we can do is our small little bit in the day, and to be grateful for the good things and the good people that we have. But without a doubt, it's a tricky time, and everyone should be kinder to themselves and kinder to others, because we don't know what's going on in another person's head.
Oh, lovely Marion Keyes, as heard on Miriam on Sunday. So pandemic pressure no more. Let's just get through it. So thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. And we're going to finish up with the late John Prine, joined here by Iris Dement.
She don't like her eggs all runny. She thinks crossing her legs is funny. She looks down her nose at money. She gets it on like the Easter Bunny. She's my baby, I'm her honey. I'm never gonna let her go.
He ain't got laid in a month of Sundays. I caught him once and he was sniffing my undies. He ain't too sharp, but he gets things done. Drinks his beer like it's oxygen. He's my baby, and I'm his honey. Never gonna let him go.
In spite of ourselves, we'll end up sitting on a rainbow. Against all odds, honey, we're the big door prize. We're gonna spike our noses right off of our faces. There won't be nothing but big old hearts dancing in our eyes. She thinks all my jokes are corny. Convict movies make her horny. She likes ketchup on her scrambled eggs. Swears like a sailor when she shaves her legs. She takes a licking and keeps on ticking. I'm never gonna let her go.
He's got more balls than a big brass monkey. He's a whacked out weirdo and a love bug junkie. Sly as a fox, crazy as a loon. Payday comes and he's a howling at the moon. But he's my baby, I don't mean maybe. Never gonna let him go.
In spite of ourselves, we'll end up sitting on a rainbow. Against all odds, honey, we're the big door prize. We're gonna spike our noses right off of our faces. There won't be nothing but big old hearts dancing in our eyes. In spite of ourselves, we'll end up a sitting on a rainbow. against all odds. Honey, we're the big door prize. Oh, we're gonna spike our noses right off of our faces. There won't be nothing but big old hearts dancing in our eyes. There won't be nothing but big old hearts dancing in our eyes. In spite of ourselves.